I'm Bill Murphy here with the Front Pages. I'll be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant and taking a look at the main pictures on the front pages of each paper. On the front page of the New York Times, a picture of, I believe it's a woman holding her baby. This is taking place in Afghanistan. She's standing in the road there. Looks like there are some vans behind her and a couple people in the distance. And I'm going to read the caption. It says, "Displaced Afghans in Kabul, the European Union pledged $1.15 billion as world leaders meet virtually to discuss aid." We're not going to have a story on that. I'm going over to the Hartford Courant, and there's a picture of Lassell Market in Collinsville. And it says that Lassell Market in Collinsville is one of many Connecticut restaurants looking for staff. And there's a picture of the building, and I'll just read some of the posters that are in the front. It says, "Help wanted, open positions, pizza maker, cashier, short order, line cook, food service, runners, apply within." And looks like they're closed right now because I see the sign that looks like it's on the door. It says, "Sorry, we're closed," underneath it. And I'm going to read a little more on the top of this picture. It says, ending extra pandemic unemployment payments so far was supposed to address the staffing crisis at Connecticut restaurants. So far, it hasn't. And we will have a story on that. That'll be my first story from the Hartford Courant. Going over to the New York Times now for the first story. This is from Baker, Louisiana. "Over the last year and a half, a majority of the roughly 40 police officers who patrol Baker, Louisiana, a suburb of Baton Rouge, tested positive for the coronavirus. All of them recovered and went back to work until Lieutenant DeMarcus Dunn got sick. Lieutenant Dunn, a 36-year-old shift supervisor who coached youth sports and once chased down someone who fled the police station after being arrested, died from COVID-19 on August 13th. His wedding had been scheduled for the next day. Chief Carl K. Dunn said he had assumed that the lieutenant, a distant relative, was vaccinated but thought it would be inappropriate to ask. It was not until after the death, the chief said, that he was told Lieutenant Dunn had not gotten a shot. For some others in the department who had been resisting vaccination, it was a turning point. They were like, 'Oh, look, wait a minute,' Chief Dunn recalled last month. 'Those are the ones that started getting it after DeMarcus left us.' More than 460 American law enforcement officers have died from COVID-19 infections tied to their work since the start of the pandemic, according to the officer down memorial page, making the coronavirus by far the most common cause of duty-related deaths in 2020 and 2021. More than four times as many officers have died from COVID-19 as from gunfire in that period. There is no comprehensive accounting of how many police officers have been sickened by the virus, but departments across the country have reported large outbreaks in the ranks. While the virus has ravaged policing, persuading officers to take a vaccine has often been a struggle, even though the shots have proved to be largely effective in preventing severe disease and death. Some elected officials say police officers have a higher responsibility to get vaccinated because they are regularly interacting with members of the public and could unknowingly spread the virus. The debate echoes concerns from earlier in the pandemic when police officers in some cities resisted wearing masks in public. Yet as more departments in recent weeks have considered requiring members to be vaccinated, officers and their unions have loudly pushed back, in some cases threatening resignations or flooding systems with requests for exemptions. In San Jose, California, city leaders decided just as a vaccine mandate was taking effect to allow unvaccinated officers to remain employed through the end of the year with incremental discipline and testing requirements. Mayor Sam Liccardo of San Jose said he wanted to keep as many police officers as possible on the job, but worried about the public health risks of having unvaccinated officers on the streets. "It's a huge challenge, and I think mayors throughout the country are balancing the safety imperatives of responding to 9 when one calls against the safety imperatives of having a vaccinated workforce, Mr. Liccardo said. But the officers have leverage. Many police departments have an abundance of job openings and a dearth of qualified applicants. And city leaders say they do not want to risk a mass departure of officers at a time when homicides have surged nationally. If you decide to move forward with mandating this vaccine, the loss of officers is on you, Josh Carter, an officer in Leesburg, Virginia, said at a recent meeting where town council members considered a vaccine mandate for municipal workers and decided not to vote on it that day. I'm going to come back and ask what your plan is to keep my family and my neighbors safe with little to no officers patrolling our streets or our schools, Mr. Carter told the council. Still, proponents of the mandate have noted that there are risks to the public in not requiring the shots. Mayor Kelly Burke of Leesburg and the Washington Experts said she favored requiring vaccines. We have a job, and that job is also to protect. And there's a component of that protection, Ms. Burke, a Democrat, said, of the town's police force. And so if they're not vaccinated, if they're not willing to wear masks, then it becomes a real problem. And we're going to move over now to the Hartford Courant. And I'm going to read that story that accompanies the picture that I had described at the top of the broadcast. When expanded COVID-19 unemployment benefits ended September 4th, many anticipated that the worker shortages in Connecticut that have limited restaurant hours, delayed openings, and pushed owners to the breaking point would end, but that hasn't been the case. There's been no uptick whatsoever in applications, Allison Dorenzi, owner of Ligorcio, said, even with four ads running simultaneously. Ligorcio, an upscale Italian restaurant in New Haven, is in the middle of a staffing crisis after losing a handful of key employees from its already lean kitchen staff. Finally, she received a resume for an open dishwasher position. The applicant came in for an interview. Dorenzi offered the job, and they agreed to start the next day. And then he vanished. He comes into the kitchen. It's a clean kitchen, no dishes to wash, Dorenzi said. The guy stands there for 10 minutes and then, poof, disappears. Oh, yeah, it's a challenge. Lorcio is just one example. Virtually every restaurant in the state is feeling the effects of an industry-wide workforce shortage that has forced restaurateurs to limit their hours or reduce capacity. Diners are eager to go out, in part thanks to Connecticut's relatively strong vaccination rate and the waning effects of the Delta variant. But rising labor and food costs are cutting dangerously into profit margins heading into an uncertain winter. Federal unemployment programs authorized under the CARES Act expired in Connecticut September 4th. September also saw the end of Connecticut's high extended benefits program, which can be triggered during periods of high statewide unemployment and adds an extra 7 weeks of benefits. Some anticipated that the end of these programs would help stimulate job growth, but it hasn't proved true so far in the restaurant industry. Robert Macarelli, who works in Liv's Oyster Bar in Old Saybrook and is an independent restaurant consultant, said it's been weeks since he's processed an application for a kitchen staff job. At Town Grill and Pizzeria in Voluntown, co-owners Judy and Camon DeFalis said they have started to receive more applications than in recent weeks, but it hasn't been enough. With a staff that's already stretched thin, Camon conveyed that he's not in a position to negotiate with potential hires. How much do you want per hour? No problem. Need to give you 2 weeks' notice before starting here? Don't worry about it. Town Grill and Pizzeria staff also now have access to a 401k plan. But of the applicants that come in interviews and hires, 99% of them don't even show up for work. It's the same situation for Gulshan Soni, the owner of the soon-to-open Shaking Crab New London Mystic. We've tried all platforms, Soni said. We post the application. We received 40, 50 applications. We call them in for an interview, and only one or two people actually showed up. And when they show up, they're not sure if they want to work or not. I don't know what the situation is right now. And we're going to move over to another story that's on the front page of The Current. This is from Hartford. About 50 refugees have arrived in Connecticut from Afghanistan over the past 2 weeks, and refugee agencies are expecting hundreds of more in the coming months, officials said Tuesday. The agencies are actively seeking donations and volunteers who can offer places to live for the evacuees. After the recent batch of 50, a New Haven-based agency is expecting another 100 to arrive over the next 2 weeks. The total of 200 is normally the amount that is resettled over an entire year, said Chris George, executive director of Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services, known as IRIS, capital I-R-I-S. There is no way in the world that the refugee settlement agencies of Connecticut or of this country can resettle so many people in such a short period of time, George said. We need help, and that help is coming from many private citizens, volunteers, church members, people from synagogues, mosques, rotary clubs, universities, or just people off the street who want to help. He added, they're forming groups, getting some training from us, and we'll be placing refugee families with them. Bravo for Volunteers of America who have stepped forward to help us through this crisis. Well, many of them are being resettled in the greater New Haven area. Those arriving in the upcoming week will include sponsors in Hartford, Old Lyme, Sanford, and other communities. On an emergency basis, some families are placed in hotels before they are later settled into apartments. In addition, some are temporarily staying with Afghan families as they wait for apartments. Still others have moved into apartments that IRIS had arranged in advance of this arrival, said Ann O'Brien, a spokeswoman for IRIS. Over the next 6 to 9 months, an additional 500 refugees are expected. Overall, Connecticut could eventually host more than 1,000 Afghan refugees, which would be similar to the number in 2016 when refugees were fleeing from Syria. With a larger-than-normal influx, George is taking a new tactic. Probably for the first time in my career at IRIS, 16 years, I am asking people if they want to help, not to write a check, George said. Form a community group instead. Pull together a group of volunteers from your community. Contact us. We will train you, and we will place a family with you. That is the best way people can help right now. He added, of course, if you can't do that, financial donations are always helpful because I have to hire more staff. We have to rent more apartments. We have to put people in hotels because we don't have apartments ready. There are a lot of additional expenses. It's a huge strain, but we're adjusting. And with the help of the people of Connecticut, we'll get through this. And going back to the front page of the Current. With the calendar slipping toward a new deadline, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that difficult decisions must be made to trim President Joe Biden's expansive plans for reimagining the nation's social service programs and tackling climate change. Democrats are laboring to chisel the $3.5 trillion package to about $2 trillion, a still massive proposal that would be paid for with higher taxes on corporations and the wealthy. And with no votes to spare, they must somehow satisfy the party's competing moderate and progressive lawmakers needed for any deal. It's all raising tough questions that Biden and his party are rushing to answer by the October 31st deadline for passage. Should Biden keep the sweep of his proposals, free child care and community college, dental, vision, and hearing aid benefits for seniors, but for just a few years? Or should the ideas be limited to a few key health education programs that could become more permanent? Should the climate change effort go bold, a national clean energy standard, or stick with a more immediate, if incremental, strategy? The fact is that if there are fewer dollars to spend, there are choices to be made. In his party are left to deliberate among themselves along familiar lines, centrists and moderates, with all eyes still on two key holdouts, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, whose votes are crucial in the evenly divided Senate. Time is growing short for the president on what has been his signature domestic policy initiative, first unveiled in March and now having consumed much of his fitful first year in office. Biden's approval rating is down after a turbulent summer, and impatience is growing, particularly among House lawmakers, heading into tough elections and is eager to show voters an accomplishment, unlike senators whose staggered six-year terms leave only some of them facing re-election in 2022. At the White House, Biden agrees that this is really the point where decisions need to be made. Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Tuesday, conversations are quietly underway with Manchin and Sinema, who continue to infuriate or reject The president's view is that we're continuing to make progress. We're having important discussions about what a package that is smaller than $3.5 trillion would look like, Psaki said. The debate among Democrats is part substance, part strategy. The White House and lawmakers are considering which proposals would bring the most benefit to the most Americans and also how best to accomplish their goals with fewer dollars. On one side, the progressive argue for keeping the broad scope of Biden's vision with many different programs, even if they expire in just a few years. The idea is to view shorter terms as an opportunity with lawmakers free to campaign in the future for their renewal. Progressive leaders said Tuesday they are willing to reduce the duration of some programs to less than 10 years as a way to lower costs, but they are unwilling to yield on their core priorities of child care, health care, climate change, action, and others. Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington State, leader of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, said their priorities are, quote, not some fringe wish list, unquote, but the agenda the president and Democrats campaigned on. And we have one more story that's on the front page of The Current. In the midst of an epic battle in Congress over his legislative agenda, President Joe Biden will travel to Connecticut Friday to visit Hartford and attend the dedication of the Dodd Center for Human Rights at UConn. We are deeply honored that President Biden is joining us as we dedicate ourselves to extending the Dodd family legacy, said UConn President Andrew Akwabobi. UConn is honoring over a half century of public service of Connecticut's father and son, U.S. Senators Thomas J. Dodd and Christopher J. Dodd, as well as the commitment of the Dodd family to supporting the growth and development of UConn's widely recognized human rights, academic research, and engagement programs. The Dodd Center for Human Rights will serve as an umbrella home for UConn's human rights programs. It had been known as the Thomas J. Dodd Research Center since its opening in 1995, and UConn's Board of Trustees voted unanimously in August to authorize its dedication as the Dodd Center for Human Rights. Biden and Chris Dodd served together in the U.S. Senate and have long been close. I'm deeply grateful to UConn for recognizing me and my family by dedicating the Dodd Center for Human Rights, and I'm honored that my good friend President Biden is joining us to mark this occasion, Dodd said in a statement released Tuesday. Biden has been touring the country to win public support for his infrastructure bill and his Build Back Better agenda. In Connecticut, he will highlight the importance of investing in child care to keep costs down for working families, according to a statement from the White House press office. Governor Ned Lamont said Biden will be in Connecticut to talk about child care and his infrastructure initiative before heading to UConn. We are really happy that President Biden is coming back to Connecticut. We are going to do something at a child care facility in the Hartford area and then go out to the Dodd Center at UConn, Lamont said Tuesday. The White House has not released details about the Hartford segment of the visit. Mayor Luke Bronin said he is coordinating with state officials and members of Biden's advance team. We're thrilled to have the opportunity to host the president in Hartford and to highlight what the Build Back Better legislation would mean for families here in Hartford and around the country, Bronin said. And we are going to go to the World and Nation section. I have one short story here before the weather. From Cheyenne, Wyoming, cross-country traveler Gabby Patino was strangled, a Wyoming coroner announced Tuesday. Patino, 22, died 3 to 4 weeks before her body was found September 19th near an undeveloped camping area along the border of Grand Teton National Park in remote northern Wyoming, Teton County Coroner Dr. Brent Blue said in a news conference. It wasn't clear if the determination might lead to additional charges against Petito's boyfriend and traveling partner, Brian Laundrie, who was considered a person of interest in her disappearance and remains unaccounted for. Blue declined to say more about the autopsy or the case overall, saying he was prevented by Wyoming law that limits what coroners can release. Petito had been on a cross-country trip with Laundrie, visiting Colorado, Utah, and other states. She was reported missing September 11th by her parents after she did not respond to calls and texts for several days when the couple visited national parks. Blue previously classified Petito's death as a homicide, meaning her death was caused by another person, but had not disclosed how she was killed. Autopsy results. A detailed analysis analysis led to his conclusion that Petito was strangled, Blue said. Nothing is obvious in a case like this, he said. Blue said a little more about Petito's physical condition, including whether she may have been strangled directly by somebody's hands, a rope, or some other item, but noted when asked that she wasn't pregnant. The 3 to 4 weeks her body was believed to be in the wilderness, however, put her death around the August 27th to 30th period.